This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Rapper Kendrick Lamar made history with his Pulitzer win. A Southwest Airlines flight made a successful emergency landing.
Is your airplane physically on fire?
No, it's not on fire, but part of it's missing.
And we heard a lot both from James Comey and from the CEO of Starbucks.
Of all the people to be fired by Donald Trump, my guest tonight is definitely one of them.
Sitting across from these young men and really trying to understand how this could happen in today's society in a Starbucks. In a Starbucks where our mission is around the human experience.
Those were Stephen Colbert introducing James Comey on The Late Show and Kevin Johnson, the CEO of Starbucks, speaking on CNN. There was so much news this week, we decided to try our first ever midweek roundup on Wednesday. It went great. You can hear it online. Just search for Wednesday News Roundup online at the1a.org. But amazingly, the news didn't stop. So here we are doing the roundup again. And joining us today to make sense of this week's top stories is Priscilla Alvarez, an assistant editor at The Atlantic. Priscilla, welcome back.
Pleasure to be here.
We're pleased to welcome Josh Gerstein, a senior reporter for Politico. Josh, welcome to 1A.
Hey, Joshua, good to be with you again.
And Alexis Simmendinger is here. She's a national political correspondent for The Hill. Alexis, good to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Let's begin with former FBI Director James Comey. His long-discussed memos of his time at the White House have been released to lawmakers by the Justice Department. Hours later, 15 pages of those documents leaked, first to the Associated Press and then to other news outlets. Those memos cover a range of interactions that Comey had with President Trump and others during the first 3 months of the Trump administration. According to those documents, the president asked Comey if he could put reporters in jail. He discussed Russian prostitutes with Vladimir Putin, and he accused former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn of having, quote, serious judgment issues. Alexis, let me start with you. There's so much in these memos. What would you say are the one or two biggest things that we learned from them?
Well, first of all, I think we should all remember that James Comey has been on a book tour and has testified. And we know that he has said this again and again. We know that the New York Times actually got the memos a year ago as a leak from James Comey through an intermediary. So we've had lots and lots of previews before we actually saw these 15 pages. But what I thought was interesting for me as someone who has covered President Trump was how animated he seemed in the 15 pages, at least from the memorialization from James Comey, about the topics of, for instance, trying to deny the idea that he in any way was involved with prostitutes in Moscow, even though he referenced a conversation with Vladimir Putin that I still would like to know more about. I thought it was interesting that the president was puzzled, as a new president would be. I understood why he would be puzzled, that James Comey was telling him, we're not investigating you. And I have told Congress that, too. And the president was asking him, well, can you please say this in public, that I feel that I'm really under a cloud? And I think most people can understand why the president was puzzled about that. And then it goes on to talk about leaks, which, of course, in the news business, we're very interested in, because it was only months later that James Comey himself leaked the memos to the New York Times after denigrating leakers.
Josh Gerstein, I'm glad you mentioned the anecdote about Vladimir Putin. Some of these are rather lurid. Vladimir Putin describing Russian prostitutes as, in his words, the most beautiful in the world. Which of the anecdotes in these memos do you consider to actually be the most salient, the most important, especially in the context of the Mueller investigation?
Well, to me, it underscored the challenging relationship the president has had with the truth historically and both in these conversations. Comey doesn't really dwell on it, but there's a couple notes in there that I thought were interesting in terms of the president's veracity. At one point, he talks about the transcripts that were leaked of his conversations with various world leaders, and he says there are things in there that he doesn't remember having said, which is kind of an interesting comment for him to make that raises sort of two possibilities. One is that the transcripts weren't accurate, and we haven't heard that from anybody else, so I'm going to kind of assume that they are accurate. And the other is that he kind of doesn't recall or might even potentially deny things that he actually may have been recorded saying, which is a pretty loose relationship with the truth. And then the other time that comes up here is in the conversation that the Comey had with the president. There's a mention at one point that he said, you know, Reince Priebus doesn't know anything about this meeting that we're having. I think it was the dinner the two of them had together. I've kept it on the QT from him. And then towards the end of the conversation, he says, I told Reince that we're going to be meeting. And it's just sort of the kind of mental wandering that makes you wonder what investigators and others would think about how much stock to put in the president's word.
Priscilla Alvarez, I wonder what you think of some of the reaction we've gotten from the president thus far, including on Twitter. Here are two of the tweets he's written within the last 15 hours or so. The president wrote, the president tweeted, quote, James Comey memos just out and show clearly that there was, all caps, no collusion and, all caps, no obstruction. Also, he leaked classified information. Wow. Will the witch hunt continue? Unquote. And then about 7 hours after that, he writes, quote, so General Michael Flynn's life can be totally destroyed while shady James Comey can leak and lie and make lots of money from a third-rate book, parenthesis, that should never have been written. Is that really the way life in America is supposed to work? I don't think so. Unquote.
So a lot of what we are seeing in the memos is exactly what Alexa said. We have heard it in his testimony. We have seen some of this come out before, and it is chronicled in his book, A Higher Loyalty, which came out this week. I think it's interesting that Trump also talks about Michael Flynn in his tweets, because Flynn also came up in the memos. Comey recalls that Trump had questioned the judgment of Flynn after he had not promptly told the president about a call to congratulate him on his inauguration shortly after that happened. So a lot of the pushback we're seeing from the president about these memos specifically, but Comey in general, matches what we've seen before and is just probably going to continue, particularly as Comey continues his book tour and we hear more tidbits of information and details from those interactions.
Yeah, he's been on the book tour. He's been making the rounds. He's been on NPR and CNN. He was on MSNBC last night. He did tell The View on ABC that he does regret one paragraph in the book where he describes President Trump.
If I had it to do over again, I wouldn't put that paragraph in, even though, just because it gave people a handhold who hadn't read the book to attack the book, and I just want people to read the book so it can be useful to them.
Yeah.
But that would have made it inconsistent with everything else. One of my heroes was my first boss when I worked in a grocery store. I describe him in great detail, his shoes, his pants, his belt, his... And so I wasn't trying to pick on him. I really wasn't trying to pick on Donald Trump. I could hear my editor's voice saying, bring the reader, bring the reader.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I'm trying to do. And I wasn't making fun of his hands. In fact, I say in the book, his hands seem normal size to me. I'm not, I really was not.
James Comey commenting on ABC's The View. We are speaking to Priscilla Alvarez of The Atlantic, Josh Gerstein of Politico, and Alexis Simmendinger of The Hill. By the way, has anyone here read the book? I've not had a chance to read it yet.
I've read it.
You've read it?
Yeah.
Any early reactions or revelations, or was it kind of what we expected?
It was largely what we expected, but I thought it was interesting the degree to which Comey, both in the book and in the subsequent book tour, was actually willing to get into the political back and forth. He never uses the kind of language publicly that Trump uses on Twitter, for example, like when Trump earlier this week called Comey a slime ball, for example. But he has described the president as morally unfit. And so it's sort of a more erudite version of what Trump is saying. And I think one of the dangers for Comey is that when you get into that kind of a back and forth, you know, there's no way to get into the mud pit without getting dirty. And that's part of what has happened with Comey here. I think his above the fray kind of image just can't survive when he's down there seeming to duke it out back and forth. And also when he gets explicitly political. In the ABC interview, he specifically called on people to go to the ballot booth, to go to the ballot box and, you know, vote for the president's opponents. And there's no way you can do that without becoming part of the partisan divide.
I know we got to move on momentarily, but a quick question about the provenance of these memos. Mallory tweeted, please stop saying Comey leaked his personal notes. They were his personal notes, so not classified, therefore not a leak. I wonder, Alexis, if you could sum up for us just kind of these notes. What exactly were they and why did the Justice Department release them now?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, the Justice Department received a subpoena from Republican committees in Capitol Hill and responded to that and received them. And I know there's a lot of questions today about why Republicans on the Hill were so eager to disclose the memos, because they are so consistent with what the former FBI director has been saying publicly. In other words, it's a little hard to read through and say, why would this help the Republican arguments? But actually, just to go back, why did the FBI director make the notes? He made the notes because he was so struck by the conversations he had with the president and made them contemporaneously. They were his personal notes, but he did use a very circuitous way to get them to the New York Times.
Longtime fans of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me know the voice of its former announcer and scorekeeper, Carl Castle.
Hello. You have reached the voicemail of Amy, Michael, and Helen. And yes, all you NPR listeners, this is Carl Castle. Now, surely you're not calling just to hear the dulcet tones of my voice, but if you are, get a life. Otherwise, leave a message for the Salvadors. Wait, wait, don't tell me till you hear the beep.
The veteran public radio newscaster passed away this week at the age of 84. A personalized voicemail greeting was just one of the things that endeared him to generations of NPR listeners. The Radio Hall of Fame inducted Castle in 2010, and he was named North Carolinian of the Year in 2013. The world also said goodbye to former First Lady Barbara Bush this week. She was married to former President George H.W. Bush for 73 years. Barbara Bush is survived by her husband and five children, including the former President George W. Bush and former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. She lived to be 92. Let's talk now about New York's former mayor, Rudy Giuliani. He has joined President Trump's legal team, along with two other federal prosecutors. The move comes about a month after the resignation of lead attorney John Dowd, who had clashed with the group about strategy. Priscilla Alvarez, what do we know about Rudy Giuliani as a mayor, as a political figure, as a lawyer, that might explain why he's now part of the president's legal team?
So a lot of people might remember Rudy Giuliani not only from his tenure in New York and the different roles that he filled there, but also from the campaign trail. He was a ardent supporter of President Trump. So it almost seems natural at this point that that is someone that Trump would bring on, people that have shown themselves and demonstrated themselves to be loyal to him. And so in this case, Rudy Giuliani is telling reporters that he wants to bring an end to the investigation, which is exactly what Trump has said. It's a far more complicated than that. This is a very expansive Russia probe that Mueller is investigating. So what will come of it is something that we'll see in the coming weeks. But Rudy Giuliani is certainly makes sense and that at this point to a degree for Trump to bring on as someone that has consistently been behind him. An interesting point, however, is that he was the led the Southern District of New York, which is investigating Michael Cohen, Trump's personal lawyer. So some ties there as well.
The U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, which includes the city of New York.
Yes.
Manhattan,
right. And we should be clear that this is the president's personal legal team.
Yes.
Alexis, can we infer anything from hiring Rudy Giuliani about what that team's legal strategy might be going forward? What role would Rudy Giuliani fit that maybe has not been filled yet or needed to be bolstered by him?
Well, I think the president has been described as the client from hell, in that he has a very strong view about what kind of representation he wants, and he has a very, very strong view about where the Mueller investigation, the special counsel investigation, has been going. And definitely he feels very strongly about what's happening with Michael Cohen and the investigation as it's proceeding there in New York. So it seems clear that the president and Giuliani have known each other a long time in New York, and Rudy Giuliani is known for being an articulate spokesperson on television, for instance, and the president, that would appeal to the president. If you need an advocate who can navigate both a legal part of it and the communications part of it, Rudy Giuliani fits that bill. We know the president has gone back and forth in the kinds of advice that he has received about whether he should sit down and do an interview with Robert Mueller. For a while there, it seemed like that was off, and now we can see that the emphasis from the president has been, I'd like to wrap this up as soon as possible. So we'll see whether that comes back into the arena. The president's gotten lots of advice, don't do it, don't do it.
Let's talk a bit now about Michael Cohen. The fallout continues after FBI agents raided his office, his home, and his hotel room last week. Mr. Trump's personal lawyer and longtime fixer appeared in court on Monday, where revelations about a certain TV personality set off gasps and some laughter in the gallery. Josh Gerstein, this had to do with his work with Sean Hannity, the Fox News host who appears in primetime. Where does that stand right now? Mr. Hannity has tried to make it clear that the connection between him and Michael Cohen is not as big a deal as people have been making it out to be.
Right. Hannity said it was minor work, that he didn't compensate Cohen for it. It was basically some legal advice, largely having to do with real estate issues. But it's still curious why Hannity never thought to mention that he had a direct personal connection to the same lawyer that was at the heart of this battle. And so the Hannity part of the story has moved more in the journalistic sort of ethics kind of world. And who knows if the word journalistic is even the right word to apply. But what are the obligations of, let's say, a media personality, even if you don't want to necessarily call Hannity a journalist, to let people know when he or she has a dog in the fight, beyond the obvious dog that many, you know, partisan focused or strongly ideological commentators put forth in any of their public discussions.
Mr. Hannity did defend himself on Twitter, on his radio show, on his website. Here's part of what he said on Fox News pretty soon after the news broke.
Here's the truth. Michael Cohen never represented me in any legal matter. I never retained his services. I never received an invoice. I never paid Michael Cohen for legal fees.
It's part of what Sean Hannity said on Fox News in response to this revelation. Priscilla, what kind of fallout could we see for Hannity here? As I understand it, Fox News has said that it talked to Mr. Hannity and it still puts its full support behind him.
I think Josh is right here. It sort of moved into what we consider to be ethical in journalism. Should he have disclosed that he had ties to Cohen on, in his show where he discusses him at length and sort of what has and denouncing the investigation as a whole. It's not quite clear how the American public is going to digest this, whether how much they're going to care about these, issues that have been coming up ethically. But I think what's interesting here is that Cohen, the FBI raided his home, his hotel room, and his office. And the key here is the FBI. And I was looking at a poll just to see sort of how Americans are thinking about the FBI. And this month, there's been an increase in Americans who believe the FBI is biased against Trump in the past 2 months. So I think in the context of that, it'll be interesting to see how this Hannity fallout comes out, as well as Cohen.
Let's back up to Rudy Giuliani for just a moment. John emailed, does anybody remember Giuliani during the Trump campaign talking about impending news about Hillary Clinton? He seems complicit in the Russia mess. Alexis, what about that?
Oh, I'm not sure about that. I haven't done any going back in time to look at that. But the entire element of the campaign was very focused on that whole narrative. And if Rudy Giuliani spent time talking about Hillary Clinton and the news that was going to come out or whatever, that was so much the talking points of the campaign.
Josh?
And there are a few different wrinkles here for Giuliani and his representation. One, I think the caller's referring to the fact that Giuliani went on TV and in radio interviews shortly before the election and seemed to have advance notice from people in the FBI, either former agents or former agents speaking to current agents, that there was an October surprise coming in the Clinton email investigation. And indeed, there was such a surprise when we learned that there were more Clinton emails on that Anthony Weiner laptop that now many people say threw the entire election away from Hillary Clinton and towards Donald Trump. So Giuliani played a role in bringing that information out. I don't know, as a former government employee and a former prosecutor, if he had any particular duty not to relay whatever people were telling him. Generally, we hold the leakers responsible as opposed to the people who are getting the information. But there's other things Giuliani did. He was a vice chair of the president's transition team. What that substantively meant, I'm not terribly sure, but he at least had that position. And he and his law firm have done a lot of work relating to Turkey. And so these are all things that intersect with aspects of the Mueller investigation. So I think one thing to keep a look at as we go forward here, some of the hiccups with the president's legal team in the past have been that conflicts were not adequately ironed out. And it'll be interesting to see in the coming days how Rudy Giuliani explains how why those various issues I just mentioned aren't a concern for him being a representative for Trump going forward.
Much more we'd like to discuss in the roundup, but before we move forward, Ben tweeted, "You play the Night Court theme, but don't mention the passing of Harry Anderson? Good ears, Ben. Well done. We did that. It was a little Easter egg. I'm glad that you picked it up. Harry Anderson, the actor who played Judge Harry Stone on the NBC 80s sitcom Night Court, did pass away this week at the age of 65. Good ears. Nicely done. Let's talk about Starbucks. It caused a stir this week when two black men were arrested at a Philadelphia location last weekend. A manager called the police to the coffee shop when two friends and business partners, Dante Robinson and Rashawn Nelson, sat down but did not order anything. They were waiting for a third member of their group to show up. A woman seated nearby recorded the incident and it went viral, sparking days of protests at that Starbucks. The CEO of the company, Kevin Johnson, responded in a video.
I want to begin by offering a personal apology to the two gentlemen who were arrested in our store. What happened and the way that incident escalated and the outcome was nothing but reprehensible. And I'm sorry.
That was Kevin Johnson, the CEO of Starbucks. Mr. Robinson and Mr. Nelson sat down for an interview on Good Morning America with ABC's Robin Roberts.
You know, this is something that has been going on for years and everyone's blind to it. But they know what's going on, if you get what I mean. And, you know, just really taking those actions and putting them in a place and, you know, help people understand that it's not just a black people thing. This is a people thing.
Those were Dante Robinson and Rashawn Nelson, part of that interview with Mr. Robinson and Mr. Nelson on ABC's Good Morning America. Priscilla Alvarez, what do we expect to happen next with all of this? What's going on here?
So Starbucks also announced that on May 29th, they are going to close their stores to give an anti-bias training. We're not quite sure the details of that training in the sense of what exactly that entails, but we know some top lines that the company released, and that is that it will address implicit bias. It'll promote conscious inclusion and prevent discrimination. And this is all from the company. They're also seeking expert input that will also weigh in on this training, and that would include the Equal Justice Initiative, the NAACP, and former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder. There are two sides to this. There are people that see this as a step forward. It is a gesture by Starbucks, and it is a good move to give this anti-bias training in all their U.S. stores. Others argue, however, that it's not just a one-day thing. This needs to be an ongoing conversation, and that it needs to be there needs to be efforts within stores to make sure they're racially integrated, to make sure that minorities are in leadership. So I think this is an ongoing conversation and not just one that Starbucks will have, but I'm sure that other companies will also have to consider moving forward from this episode.
Alexis?
One other thing I think is interesting is because Starbucks is known to advertise, come in and stay a while, that they're a coffee shop, they want people to come and actually congregate there to stay there to enjoy what they obviously sell, but also to enjoy the environment. That it's an important blow for this particular company. It's an expensive thing for the company. It's definitely a bruise to their brand. And it's very expensive to imagine the company feeling that this was so important that they had to shut down. They knew, they understood the challenge of, in this day and age, with the kind of business that they have, what is loitering? Who can use our restrooms? Are they public restrooms? Do you have to actually pay to buy something before? This is, you know, we see this in lots of areas around the country, not just urban areas. We see these questions, and it's interesting to see them heightened and discussed.
It's interesting. You know, Howard Schultz, who was kind of the mastermind of Starbucks, has described Starbucks as a third place. You have home, which is your first place. You have work, which is your second place. And then there's this other place where you spend most of your time. And it used to be, you know, the corner coffee shop or the diner or the soda fountain or wherever, the mall. And in many places, Starbucks has become our third place to the point where, you know, if you got to run in and use the restroom, you might think, okay, fine. Well, let me buy a bottle of water and then I'll go to the bath. Like, you just get that it's part of your life. But Josh, Starbucks has struggled with race before. I mean, it tried to start a conversation on race some years ago with a campaign called Race Matters, where baristas were supposed to be willing to talk to you about race as you were ordering and heading out the door. And that didn't go very well. So it seems like despite the company's best efforts, this kind of keeps coming up. Maybe it's just endemic to the times in which we live, and it could have happened anywhere.
I think it could have happened anywhere. I mean, they have, what, 8,000 stores or something like that, and this kind of an incident, obviously, you're not going to be able to perfectly train, even if you take half a day or you go over it every week, every single employee. But I'm struck also by the role of the video in this incident. I think this whole story and narrative could have played out very differently in the absence of that video. I see it easily devolving into kind of a Rashomon situation where it would have been alleged that these men in the store were boisterous or rude or were acting out in some other improper way. And you would have had the usual battle of the talking heads on cable news and elsewhere saying that, you know, there's more sides to this, two sides to this story, and there was some kind of provocation and, you know, so forth. And I think the video made this such a incident where it was really hard for people to argue that these gentlemen had done anything wrong, let alone anything that, you know, merited them being arrested, and made it very difficult to explain away this situation.
Green Moon Art tweeted, "I don't hear anyone talking about the fact that 911 was called. 911 is for life and death emergencies." Priscilla, there's also that aspect of the story that somebody decided to call the police. This could have ended a lot worse.
Right. And the two men acknowledged that also in interviews this week, saying that at one point one of them mentioned that he even thought about his life and what was going to happen next. The Philadelphia Police Department has largely defended their actions. They acted as they were called upon to do. But the commissioner did apologize to the two men and said that the episode warranted a policy change. So that will be a separate conversation within the department of how they, you know, move forward in that regard.
I know we have to pause in a moment, but I wonder if Starbucks gets any credit for its handling of this. I mean, it seems like the company tried to get out ahead of this once the video dropped, and closing every Starbucks, even for a day, is a gigantic step. So maybe that's a little progress.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it still goes back to Starbucks has been around a while. This is not the first time they've had conversations about how do they want to treat their customers, and the fact that this, as you say, is not a new issue that has come up indicates that the management part of this chain, obviously, it's not all, some of them are franchises, but it's interesting to see how they've reacted.
Back to the Sean Hannity story for a second. Mel is listening in Potomac, Maryland. Mel emailed, "How is Hannity not a journalist? Because he is not a reporter? Richard Cohen, E.J. Dionne, and Michael Gerson of The Washington Post are opinion columnists, not reporters, but aren't they journalists?"
Well, I think one of the things that I would say about Sean Hannity is that he himself says he's not a journalist. So I tend to take people at what they say. He identifies himself as a commentator or an advocate, a person with a strong perspective, and he doesn't pretend to be a journalist. He doesn't describe himself that way, and Fox News doesn't describe him as, you know, they talk about him as a host or personality.
Josh?
Well, I think this has always been an issue with some of these commentators. I think as tempting as it is to try to explore the ethics of this issue, in reality, for Fox, it may well come down to money. I mean, you have to remember, it's only a year ago that they lost one of their big anchor powerhouse hosts for their evening news or evening programs, Bill O'Reilly, as a result of the sexual harassment and misbehavior scandals. And so, you know, it's just not realistic, I think, that Fox would escort another one of their huge moneymakers off the scene, except for something extraordinarily egregious. And so I think that's why you got this kind of muted statement saying we've spoken to him about it. I suspect that what he did violates some of Fox's internal guidelines, even for hosts. I mean, I don't think hosts are supposed to be out, for example, running political fundraisers or events like that, regardless of what views they present. And so this probably did cross some of those lines. And, you know, he was given a talking to, but is not going to do much to change his position on the Fox lineup.
Well, I feel like the heart of this debate about whether Sean Hannity is a journalist or not has to do with honesty. I mean, journalism is supposed to be, as I was taught in journalism school, an honest brokerage of the truth. That when we speak to you about world events or about what's happening down the street at the farmer's market, you know what dogs we have in the fight, if any. And by not disclosing that he had a connection to Michael Cohen, he was playing fast and loose with the truth. He was kind of lying to the public by purporting to have an unbiased opinion as a political commentator. But if Fox is okay with it, then maybe the audience is okay with it. I don't know. Priscilla, I feel like this is really an argument about honesty, not about the nature of journalism. We kind of know what journalism is, but we're not sure what Sean Hannity is.
Well, and he was supposed to remain anonymous, too. This was all occurred in a hearing where he was revealed as the third client of Michael Cohen. And he does comment on the investigation quite a bit, on the investigation into alleged ties with Russia, Trump campaign's alleged ties with Russia. And so when he is commenting on that and commenting on the raids into Michael Cohen's hotel room and office and not disclosing it, then yes, exactly. You do breach honesty. And I think that's what's at the question here is when he was discussing these points, why not disclose that he had some sort of legal service or had asked about some legal question conversation with Cohen.
Let's move on to another story that caught our attention this week and caught yours as well. Naldi tweeted, "The situation in Puerto Rico will not improve until the island can compete and be treated as any other location in the USA. Americans in the island voted to become the 51st state of our nation twice. Congress is ignoring the will of the people." We have talked about that political debate on this program, but right now Puerto Rico seems to have a much more urgent, in some cases, life or death problem. It's been 7 months since Hurricane Maria ravaged Puerto Rico, and an accident on the island plunged the entire island again into darkness. Priscilla, let me stick with you. Where do we know where Puerto Rico stands right now? What's happening?
So they have been able to restore powers in major parts of the island, but this is still shocking. It's 7 months since Hurricane Maria. Around $2.5 billion have been spent on recovery efforts. And I think what's most shocking and concerning is that hurricane season is set to start on June 1st, which is not very far away. And yet this island is still reeling from Hurricane Maria. So there are parts of the island that are still without power. I think one of the things that is most complicated here is that the power lines are often in the south and a lot of it runs up to the north. So you can run into a lot of these issues. But they still need help. And I think that this was a reminder that the island is not all there and it has not recovered completely yet when we're only a few months shy of the next hurricane season.
Alexis, do we get a sense that Capitol Hill is focused on helping Puerto Rico out? I mean, where does that stand right now, if anywhere?
Well, the answer is yes, in the sense that Congress is certainly aware, and certain elements of Congress, especially on the Democratic side in the House, are very animated about what's happening. There has been, in the omnibus funding bill, there's some effort to provide funding and continued funding. In the White House, though, it's interesting, the president's perspective on Puerto Rico is that it's a question of management. And his view is we as a government, his argument is, have done what we need to do, and Puerto Rico needs to improve its management.
Josh?
I'm struck by the fact how this latest incident with them losing power island-wide was sort of a single point of failure problem. It was like a backhoe trying to lift a transmission tower that took out power for the entire island. It's only about a decade and a half ago we had a blackout in the northeastern United States that lost power to 55 million people as a result of the same kind of sort of freak accident. And it does make me wonder, in the event of terrorism or other incidents like that, just how vulnerable, not just on an island, but the power grid itself is to relatively random freak occurrences that are completely disruptive to modern life.
And Major League Baseball, however, used generators and went on and played.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you remember where it was, or was it in?
In San Juan.
In San Juan. Wow.
The rest of San Juan was dark, but baseball was lighted up.
Nothing stops baseball.
Yeah.
Nothing stops baseball. Let's talk about another unusual occurrence that in this case actually had a very positive, mostly positive ending. All but one passenger of a Southwest flight from New York to Dallas survived what was truly a nightmare this week. Southwest flight 1380 had to make an emergency landing after one of its engines exploded that sent shrapnel through a window and killed one woman on board. Southwest pilot Tammy Jo Schultz has been called a hero for landing the plane successfully without any further fatalities and for her calm demeanor throughout the ordeal. Here is some of the audio of her exchange with air traffic control.
Could you have the medical meet us there on the runway as well? We've got injured passengers.
injured passengers okay? And are you, is your airplane physically on fire?
No, it's not on fire, but part of it's missing. They said there was a hole and someone went out.
I'm sorry, you said there was a hole and somebody went out? South of 1380, it doesn't matter. We'll work it out there. So the airport's just off to your right. Report it in flight, please.
Part of the air traffic control exchange with Southwest pilot Tammy Jo Schultz. The passenger who died in that plane was Jennifer Reardon, a mother of two from New Mexico. Our colleagues at KANW Public Radio in New Mexico told us that she's described as a wonderful woman who is very active in Albuquerque and in nonprofit organizations there. Do we have any more sense of what happened during this flight, of why the disaster occurred, Priscilla?
Well, so the NTSB is still working on its initial examination, but they're looking at the engine, and they're looking at the blades that a fan blade appeared to snap off. And so that's something that they're focusing on, not only on this airline, but also on the Boeing 737, and looking at which, if other 737s may have a similar issue. I think the question here is how long have they been in service? Are they aged? And can a freak accident like this happen again on some of these airlines that have been in service for quite a few years?
Josh?
I think it's also worth remembering that it was just about 4 months ago, President Trump took credit for the fact that there had been no fatalities in U.S. aviation in the previous year, and said that was the result of the strict approach that they'd taken under his administration to the airline industry. It turns out we now find out that it was in August of last year that the FAA proposed mandating inspections for these types of engines. A number of airlines protested, including Southwest, said maybe they would need up to 18 months to do these types of inspections. And the FAA never finalized that requirement. I think some airlines went ahead and began doing the inspections anyway, but there was no mandate from the government or even a specific directive. And now all of a sudden the government has stepped in and said, oh, we need to do these inspections. And Southwest, which was asking for a year and a half, is now intent on getting them done a lot sooner.
A few more things to discuss before our time is up. Congratulations to Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth. She made history in the Senate just by giving birth. That made her the first U.S. senator to have a baby while holding office in the Senate. This week, the Senate made history again. Her newborn showed up with her to vote on a Trump administration nominee. Senator Duckworth, who was a Democrat, came to work thinking she might be the deciding vote in opposition to a Republican member that was put forward, a Republican congressman that was put forward to become the new administrator of NASA. Now, that was not the case. But the presence of her daughter on the Senate floor was a first, and the daughter was wearing a jacket so as not to violate the Senate dress code. Alexis, I love this story.
Everyone loves this story.
Yeah, but there's also a little more to it.
What is not to love about this story?
Exactly, exactly.
It has everything that you would ever want. You want, you know, the senator herself is an engaging and heroic woman. Her daughter, Maylee Pearl, is adorable. And we have this sort of ancient institution, the Senate, with all these very elderly gentlemen who are all cooing and ooing and aahing. And of course, for the women senators who went to bat for Senator Duckworth and tried to help get this rule change, they were also delighted because it meant a level of change that they thought was very helpful and empowering to women everywhere who were watching the institution.
Alexis, do we have a sense of how far Congress has come, particularly in this age of Me Too, where all kinds of institutions are rethinking the way that they deal with women's issues? Senate is hidebound, I think, in some ways, to say the least. How much do we get the sense that Capitol Hill is coming along, absent the influence of people like Senator Duckworth?
Well, let's just say it's a lagging indicator. The Congress is usually not in any way at the tip of the spear of trying to make change, and they're watching what is going on around the United States. And of course, Congress is still roiled by all kinds of sexual harassment investigations and allegations, and we've still seen some of that dust up continuing. But we're also seeing, which is very interesting for those of us who watch politics, how many women around the country are engaged in running for office. They want to seek office in the House and in the Senate. And We see that in both parties, primarily, though, in among Democrats or progressives. And so I think these senators are anticipating they're going to see more women arriving in Congress. Let's make change.
We mentioned Kendrick Lamar earlier in the program, who stole a lot of thunder at the Pulitzer Prizes. The 30-year-old rapper became the first non-jazz and non-classical musician to win the Pulitzer Prize in music. The big honor, the Pulitzer for Public Service, went to the New York Times and the New Yorker for, quote, explosive, impactful journalism that exposed powerful and wealthy sexual predators, including allegations against one of Hollywood's most influential producers, bringing them to account for long-suppressed allegations of coercion, brutality, and victim silencing, thus spurring a worldwide reckoning about sexual abuse of women, unquote. Any other Pulitzer winners this year that caught your attention, Priscilla?
One of my favorites, and I really loved the photo that came out of this newsroom, was the Cincinnati Inquirer. They won a Pulitzer for their work on the opioid epidemic. They had chronicled over the course of 7 days how this epidemic really hit the city. And it was a great piece of journalism, but more than 60 reporters worked on this, too. I mean, it was a really collaborative effort. And seeing that photo come out when the news broke that they had won the Pulitzer was refreshing. It was nice.
Any others?
There's a small newspaper in California that won for breaking news covering the wildfires and the damage in California. Very gripping team effort. And it was just delightful to see, because for those of us who love small newspapers or maybe worked in one at some point, you applaud with them, and seeing their little paper cups of champagne is great.
Yeah, the Santa Rosa Press Democrat up in wine country in Sonoma. Josh?
And there was an unusual award to a freelance writer and a freelance cartoonist who had published work in the New York Times. I think we usually think of editorial cartoons in a slightly different way. This wasn't really an editorial cartoon. It was sort of almost what you would call a nonfiction graphic novel published in the pages of the New York Times, talking about two Syrian brothers who had come to the United States and the story of the trials and tribulations that they faced. And it's something that Pulitzers had not recognized before, and also just a form of presentation and a combination of art and in this case, illustration that the Times put forward that is very uncommon.
I love a graphic novel, which I think is a good segue to the final thing we'd wanted to bring up, which is a happy birthday reference, a happy 80th birthday to Superman. He debuted in the first edition of DC's Action Comics back on April 18, 1938. The Man of Steel may be America's best-known social justice warrior. Among other things, back in the late 40s, he appeared in ads denouncing racial prejudice as un-American. But a controversial story in 2015 showed him defending protesters from a SWAT team, including by punching a police officer. DC is celebrating his 80th with the 1,000th issue of Action Comics. And by the way, here's a fun fact about Superman. Kryptonite exists in many colors, not just green. Gold kryptonite would neutralize his powers permanently. Red kryptonite can cause intense pain, among other things. And black kryptonite would split him into two beings, one good and one evil. Don't say we never taught you nothing. Josh Gerstein, a senior reporter for Politico. Josh, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Joshua.
Priscilla Alvarez, an assistant editor with The Atlantic. Thanks, Priscilla.
Thanks for having me.
And Alexis Simmendinger, national political correspondent for The Hill. Alexis, enjoy your weekend.
Happy Friday.
We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Mindy Thomas.
And together, we bring you Wow in the World.
And this week, it's all about Operation Earth, how to be cool to a planet that's getting hot. So check it out with the curious, conscientious kids in your life. Listen now on Apple Podcasts.
South Korea says its rival to the North has expressed a desire for denuclearization without major conditions. That's ahead of a summit next week between Seoul and Pyongyang. Meanwhile, President Trump is expected to meet with North Korea's dictator in the next month or so, but he is already threatening to pull out of that summit. If tweets and off-the-cuff statements from the president might sometimes seem confusing, at least one member of the administration says she does not get confused. That's what America's UN ambassador Nikki Haley said when the White House contradicted her announcement that the U.S. would impose new sanctions on Russia. Plenty to discuss in the Friday News Roundup, including the trouble chemical weapons inspectors are having doing their work in Syria, Cuba without a Castro to lead it, the Windrush generation controversy that Britain's prime minister was forced to apologize for, and a dog breed that many Americans love. And so does the Queen of England. Joining us to discuss the top news around the world this week is Nancy Youssef, who covers national security for The Wall Street Journal. Nancy, welcome.
Thank you.
Paul Denihar is the BBC's Washington Bureau Chief and the author of The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks very much.
And Courtney Kuby is NBC's National Security and Military Reporter. Hi, Courtney.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with North Korea. A few days ago, President Trump tweeted that CIA Director Mike Pompeo met with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un last week. There had already been reports of a meeting between the two, possibly on Easter weekend. Courtney, let me start with you. What do we know about the meetings, how many they were, where they were, and what happened?
We know virtually nothing, actually, about what happened in the meetings. In fact, the Washington Post put out a story about it in the evening, and the administration refused to confirm it all around. And then President Trump tweeted it the next morning, much to the frustration of many reporters who spent a lot of time the night before trying to get it confirmed. What we do know is that it was intended to lay the groundwork for this ultimate meeting between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea. And some of the details of that seem to be slipping out now a little bit. None of them are really confirmed, but some locations are now being bandied about. It seems like it might be in Europe, possibly. It doesn't look like it's going to be in either on the Korean Peninsula or in the United States. But President Trump said this week that one of the things he hopes to discuss is the three Americans who are being held in North Korea. And then the South Koreans came out and said that North Korea is willing to talk about complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula without conditions, which is surprising. The North Koreans haven't actually confirmed that. And also, we don't really know what that means. We don't know exactly what North Korea would mean by complete denuclearization. Would that mean a verification process and inspections and whatnot? So at this point, President Trump seems pretty eager to actually have this meeting, but we'll see.
Here's a bit of what the president tweeted on Wednesday morning. Quote, Mike Pompeo met with Kim Jong-un in North Korea last week. Meeting went very smoothly and a good relationship was formed. Details of summit are being worked out now. Denuclearization will be a great thing for world, but also for North Korea. Unquote. And Joe asked the same question that you just addressed. What happens in a denuclearization? Nancy Youssef, even though we may not know what's going to happen with North Korea, if anything, is denuclearization a thing? Like, is there a certain pattern of events that tends to happen in this kind of situation?
Well, let me start by saying I think one of the takeaways from this is that we know that Kim Jong-un is prepared to hold talks. What we don't know is if he's prepared to denuclearize. And so perhaps the model we could use is in Iran, where we had a denuclearization program. But I'd point out that during that process, it was years of working out the details of how verification would happen, who would do the verifying. One proposal could be, for example, China doing some sort of verification process, what constitutes denuclearization, how it's defined, and what is received in return for it. And so I think the best model we have is in Iran in terms of stipulating how one goes about denuclearizing. But again, in that case, you had lower level officials working out those very specific details and then higher level coming at the very end to sort of seal the deal. In this case, we have the exact opposite, where you have Director of CIA Mike Pompeo going to North Korea, President Trump talking about meeting with Kim Jong-un, and then afterwards, it seems that they'll work out the details of what denuclearization would look like.
President Trump is already talking about the potential of him walking out of a meeting between him and Kim Jong-un that could occur as early as next month. It came up during a press conference this week at Mar-a-Lago between President Trump and Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Here is part of what President Trump said.
We've never been in a position like this with that regime, whether it's father, grandfather, or son. And I hope to have a very successful meeting. If we don't think it's going to be successful, Mark, we won't have it. We won't have it. If I think that it's a meeting that is not going to be fruitful, we're not going to go. If the meeting when I'm there is not fruitful, I will respectfully leave the meeting and we'll continue what we're doing or whatever it is that will continue, but something will happen.
President Trump speaking during a press conference this week with Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Paul, what's the president really saying here?
That's a good question. I think the issue that we've got is that when they were dealing with Iran,
There were long relationships that had been built up at different sorts of level, particularly in Europe. So there was a certain amount of confidence you could have with the people you were dealing with. They've got no idea who they're dealing with in North Korea. Everything's been done through China. So in many ways, the president is right. You know, he's going into this quite cold, even though there'll be lots of conversations going on now at different levels. And it was interesting that Bob Corker said this week that back channels have been going on for years between the intelligence services in the US and North Korea. So there will be some of that kind of back and forth that's been going on. But no one has any idea what the situation is inside North Korea, really. No one really understands exactly what the dynamic is that's going on inside Kim Jong-un's head, because one of the things that will be worrying him is he's looked at people like Gaddafi, who went through this process and gave up all of their kind of horrible chemical weapons, etc., and then got overthrown. And that's one of his big fears. So from his point of view, it's, am I going to be safe after this? And trying to make him feel safe is going to be what he's going to have to be offered. And will he then let people wander around his country checking stuff? Because that, again, won't make him feel very safe, because he's a very, very kind of closed figure that has been trying to hold on to a country that, you know, is basically kind of in the dark ages.
Nancy?
I think those are great points. I think when the president refers to that the U.S. will keep doing what it's doing now should talks not work, the assumption is that he's referring to deterrence. But one of the things that isn't spoken about enough is, if these talks fail, does that lend credence to those who want to conduct military action in North Korea, the argument being that talks failed? And I think that's one of the things that's not talked about enough when one speaks of these talks. As, you know, the president's attitudes, we're going to give it a try, but I think one must think about the consequences if those talks fail, particularly given the hawkish positions of some of his key cabinet members.
I assume you're talking about people like John Bolton, the new national security advisor, and even Mike Pompeo, the new nominee to be Secretary of State.
That's right.
Courtney, next week, the leaders of North Korea and South Korea, Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in, are scheduled to meet. What do we expect from that meeting?
So, and we already have one step towards that. Today, Friday morning local time in Korea, they had a 4-minute call between the North and the South. It was the beginning of this direct phone line that they will have to discuss things. And apparently they said it was like talking to someone right next door, which it really is.
Funny how that works.
Yes. So I think what we will all be looking for out of this summit next week is whether they make any kind of decision about the potential for negotiating a peace treaty to formally end the Korean War after nearly 65 years. A lot of people probably don't realize this, but there was an armistice. There was never actually a peace treaty. So it ended combat operations, but technically, you know, North Korea, South Korea, and the U.S. are still at war. So everyone's really looking for that. There's been some talk this week that there might be an agreement on that. But, you know, as Nancy was saying, there's always the second, third order effects. You know, if the talks were to fail between Trump and Kim Jong-un, well, if there was a peace treaty that existed, you know, one of the reasons that that hardliners in this administration think that they have the authority for preemptive strike in North Korea is because the U.S. is still at war with North Korea. If there's a peace treaty and the U.S. is no longer at war, that legal authority becomes much more questionable, any kind of a preemptive strike. So it's not as simple. President Trump came out earlier this week and said that he gives his blessing to the North and South for a potential peace treaty. But it's really not that simple as President Trump giving his blessing and then it is so.
Paul?
The other people we haven't spoken about yet are China. And they hold a really big card in all of this. Although they've been kind of slightly sidelined, there's been a lot of conversation going on behind the scenes, and we saw Kim go up to Beijing and talk to them, because at the end of the day, they've got to buy into this deal. They've been the ones in many ways that have pushed North Korea towards talking, because they got really tough in 2017 and imposed really severe sanctions on North Korea. North Korea gets 90% of its income from trade with China, and they cut back on the coal, and they cut back on food, and they cut back on clothing that was going backwards and forwards across the border. So China's got to buy into this, and China will only buy into this if they think they can maintain that buffer between the American forces and China that is North Korea. So there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes that we're not talking now, and China will be trying to have as much influence as it possibly can. What we haven't talked about is where it will be, and I think there's a very good chance it could be in Mongolia or in China, somewhere where the Chinese feel that they are playing a role in all of this, even if it's only to kind of nominally be seen to be the stage for it.
So really this is North Korea, the U.S., and China that we should be watching with, and South Korea that we should be watching with these talks.
Yeah.
There are concerns if the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, after a United Nations security team was shot at in Douma this week, OPCW inspectors have still not been able to reach the site of what is widely suspected to be a chemical attack. The UK's ambassador to the OPCW, Peter Wilson, discussed it with Ari Shapiro on All Things Considered.
I have to say, it is very hard for the inspectors to do their job without being able to go to the site. And we obviously hope they can go to the site as soon as possible. The other thing the Director General told us all in the OPCW was that the Syrian government had offered to provide 22 witnesses to the inspectors in Damascus. That is obviously, to put it mildly, suboptimal.
That's Peter Wilson, the UK's ambassador to the OPCW, speaking to Ari Shapiro on All Things Considered. Paul Danahar, what's going on here?
I'm afraid this is a tactic that we've seen pretty much ever since the Syrian civil war started and the UN tried to get involved, or any sort of international body. I mean, I went out with peace monitors, the UN, back in the early stages of the civil war, and the same thing happened. You know, they were going out somewhere at that time to kind of look into claims of atrocities. They would get so far, then they would get surrounded, they'd have to go back, or someone would fire a shot and they'd have to go back, because they don't really have, you know, their security pretty much is in the hands of the Syrians. And so this tactic of kind of delaying these teams going out and verifying or checking or looking into whether it be atrocities or whether it be chemical weapons attacks, etc., 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 that delaying process has gone on for years. And you know, you can never work out who it was that fired the gun. But, you know, let's be honest, the security in these areas is controlled by the regime, which is why they are even thinking about allowing someone in. So this is a kind of tactic that's gone on and on and on. And no doubt they'll get in eventually and it'll be completely kind of whitewashed, perhaps even literally. And they won't be able to kind of get very much out of it. And it's just, you know, we're just watching it go round and round in circles.
Courtney, it's widely accepted by much of the West that we know who was behind the attack. The West broadly assumes that Syria's President Bashar al-Assad is behind the attack. Russia claims that Britain and Syrian rebels were behind it. How does this delay impact the overall standoff between the West and Bashar al-Assad?
So the longer that it takes before the inspectors get in, the more that anything on the ground is degraded, or that, you know, the chemicals have deteriorated. So the chances of getting anything substantive that the OPCW can then report on is worse with every single day. And in fact, yesterday the State Department said that they had credible evidence that people were cleaning up the site and that the Russians and the Syrians were actively delaying the inspectors from gaining access to Douma because they wanted to sanitize the site. So what the U.S. does have is video and photos from NGOs and from some people on the ground. They have some intelligence that shows some ISR overhead photos and video that show helicopters dropping some chemicals in the area, or dropping barrel bombs that they believe had chemicals based on the way that the plume exploded. But, you know, if they had an international monitoring agency like OPCW.
OPCW, yes. Confuses me too. OPCW.
I know. One day I'll get it. Yeah. If they had something like that, it would just, you know, harden the case. The reality is Russia has come up with several different stories since this happened of who was behind it. But the U.S. has no evidence that any of the rebels in that area had access to these kinds of chemicals. They don't have a history of using them in this kind of a way. So,
and they'd have been gassing themselves. So it would have been slightly counterproductive. I mean, that's part of the issue here, is to say it was somebody else. Well, who then? I mean, you know, that's why people believe that it's being delayed, because at the end of the day, there's evidence there to suggest it happened, and they don't want people to see that.
Nancy?
I would just add the evidence as well is that after this attack, the members of the rebel group there, Jaish al-Islam, within hours was on buses leaving, and the Douma was under regime control by Wednesday. This attack happened on a Saturday. So we're in this area where we don't have irrefutable evidence that sarin was used, and yet at the same time, all evidence points to one direction. It becomes critical because the U.S. has said that it's up to the Assad regime to determine whether it'll face further strikes from the United States, but hasn't really clearly set out the parameters in which they would conduct strikes, because in the past, when there were just, and I don't mean to understate it, chlorine strikes, the United States did not do strikes. One of the reasons it justified doing it was the suspicion of sarin. And yet there's some ambiguity for some about how much sarin is used versus chlorine, and all on top of a sort of unstated and unspecific time red line from the United States about what will or will not warrant future U.S. strikes.
Courtney?
And by the way, this follows the pattern of what the Syrians have done in numerous cases, in numerous places, as they spend 6 to 8 weeks just pounding an area. They cut it off from outside. It becomes this humanitarian catastrophe. We saw it happen in Aleppo. Everyone knew it was coming in Douma. It's happening all throughout East Ghouta. And then at the end, when they just as the last thing to break the final bit of will of the people who are holding out, they come in with chemicals and then the place falls. I mean, it has happened over and over again. So, I mean, that pattern is also evidence for U.S. intelligence officials.
Does that mean that there are other targets for the Assad regime that might be the next target for a chemical attack down the road?
Yes. And that's why so many of us, as Nancy was saying, are trying to figure out, well, what's the bar? I mean, I hate to use the term, but what's the red line here? You know, we've seen there have been proven cases of them weaponizing chlorine, using it against civilians and other places in the last year since the April 2017 strikes, but nothing has happened. There was some talk back in February. The French were very vocal about it after a particularly terrible strike and an attack with weaponized chlorine. But so what happens now? Is it every single time now when there's a case of some kind of a weaponized chemical, or does it have to be a nerve agent? Do there have to be deaths? And no one can articulate that.
Well,
to
I kind of wonder, Paul, if that's part of why it's been such a slow process, because the world has already drawn a red line on chemical weapons. We kind of know chemical weapons cross the line. If there is a clear pattern, we see that it's happening. The world knows it needs to respond. Maybe this is just something the world doesn't feel like getting mired in. Maybe because they know what the path is, and no one's really willing to be the one to deal with it.
I mean, I think that what you've got to look at is the evolution of the kind of terror tactics, if you like, of the Syrian regime. At the very beginning, it was militias going in, carrying out small massacres, driving people out of their territory. Then the massacres got worse and worse and worse. Then there was people being surrounded and they were being starved out. Then they were being bombed out. And as the local kind of civilian population became more and more resilient to the tactics being used by the Syrian government, they went up to chemical weapons, which is kind of the ultimate terror tactic in many ways. The problem is that you may stop these chemical weapons being used. People will just be killed by bombs, or they'll choke to death on the dust of their building that's collapsed above them. So, you know, a lot of the language that's been used is, you know, we've been seeing some terrible scenes in Syria. Well, yeah, you have, but we've been seeing terrible scenes that didn't involve gas either. So this is really about chemical weapons proliferation. And if the US and the West believes that this is kind of setting a benchmark where other people may use them, they will strike. If they think it's just going to kill civilians and it's not going to be an expansion of the risk of chemical weapons proliferation, they'll tolerate it.
I want to shift gears to talk about Russia in a moment, but first let me get to some of your comments. Jaber tweets, groups Russia and Assad accused of carrying out the chemical weapons attack so far. Rebels on themselves, the British government, white helmets, the U.S. government, and yesterday, Israel. The French have yet to be accused. Let's bridge to Russia by way of answering this question, Nancy. Why is Russia making these claims about all these different groups being the ones behind the chemical weapons attack? I mean, I don't know if anyone would think that the white helmets would be the ones to carry out a chemical. That just sounds crazy. Why would they say that?
Well, because I think for all the ways that Courtney and Paul talked about what's happening in Syria, the alternative is that the Assad regime, the regime that they are backing, are carrying out brutal attacks on its own people. And so this is an effort to muddy the waters in terms of the details of what happened there. And frankly, for some Assad backers, it's not crazy to think that the rebels do it. Remember, for them, these aren't rebels. They're terrorists. And so for it's not out of the realm of possibility. So you have an audience of that is willing to accept that argument, and you have a Russia that is really trying to confuse already an opaque situation in Douma.
Let's back up to North Korea for just a second. Victor asked, how could Kim Jong-un go from North Korea calling President Trump a dotard to talking about denuclearization without conditions in less than a few months? Courtney?
That's an excellent question. And I think that's why there's so much skepticism about what is actually going to happen in the summit next week, in the talks with President Trump and KJU. Because so at this point, we've had years of Kim Jong-un saying the U.S. must leave the peninsula. They will not denuclearize because they use it as a deterrent, the same way the U.S. has a deterrent nuclear force, that the U.S. and South Korea must end their military exercises, that there will be no peace treaty. And now all of a sudden, there's going to be a meeting, and Kim Jong-un is saying, oh, no, it's okay. We're going to peace. We'll have a peace treaty, and we'll denuclearize, and the U.S. military doesn't have to leave. And so I think there's reason to be skeptical here of what actually he is willing to do. We also have to remember that we're hearing this through South Korea. We're not hearing any of it directly from Kim Jong-un or the regime. You know, for all we know at this point, what he really wants is the value of having that summit where he's standing next to, you know, the South Korean and the U.S. leader, the most powerful person in the world, the president of the United States, because it legitimizes him. It legitimizes him. And if he will, I can't envision a scenario where he will not be a nuclear power in a couple of weeks, but that will mean that it legitimizes him as a nuclear state and as a world leader. And whether he's actually willing to come through on any of this is, I'm skeptical personally.
One more thing on Syria before we move on from that. John asked on our Facebook page, why do we pretend that OPCW, the UN, or any international organization has authority to investigate in a sovereign nation? If we are unwilling to commit and put boots on the ground, all this posturing is pointless. Paul?
Yeah, I mean, the way that all of this works, I mean, the delivery of humanitarian aid is all reliant on going through the Syrian government. I mean, that's one of the issues here, that because people have not wanted to get involved in the war, they've not wanted to kind of, you know, put boots on the ground in any kind of massive way. It's been done through this, well, we'll work with the government and we'll do this and we'll do that. And it's not going to get resolved. And because no one has the will to actually say, we're going in big. And frankly, the time has passed. 2013, you could have made a big difference. 2012, you could have made a big difference. Now it's just an impossibly messy situation, and no one wants to get involved.
Let's talk about Russia. Virginia Daily emailed, what constitutes deserving sanctions? Interfering on our elections? Enabling Assad? Good question, Virginia. And that's kind of in the weeds, or kind of at the heart of a very public dispute between President Trump and the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, that got a lot of attention this week. On Sunday, Haley announced that the U.S. would respond to Russian support of Syria's chemical weapons with sanctions. Then on Tuesday, the White House's top economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, said that Haley, in his words, got out ahead of the curve on announcing these sanctions, and there might have been, in his words, a momentary confusion. Haley then told Fox News, with all due respect, I don't get confused. Nancy, what's going on here?
Oh, my. Well, Let's begin with, you know, on Friday when the president announced the Syria strikes, one of the things he said is that the U.S. was looking at all options in terms of types of response, military, economic, and diplomatic. And it seems that sanctions against Russian companies that might have helped the Assad regime build its chemical programs was on sort of the list of options that the United States was considering. And Nikki Haley is known to talk to the president directly, regularly, and is known as a sort of studious diplomat in terms of thinking about and how preparing her remarks publicly. And so on Sunday, she said that the United States was prepared to put those sanctions into place as early as the following day. At some point, it seems that the president was frustrated by this. We saw the White House on Monday try to say that no decision had been made. Larry Kudlow made his comments. And in just a few words, she very assertively said that she was not misspeaking. She was representing the administration's position as she understood it. Some people took this as a sign of the president's sort of reluctance to aggressively tackle Russia and its misdeeds in Syria and in the election. I personally took it as part of a pattern that we've seen in this administration of very quickly switching positions on TPP, on whether to stay in Syria, on even the timing of these strikes. And I think to me, this fit a pattern, and I think it got extra attention because it became so personal in a way.
Paul, can you clarify Larry Kudlow's role in sanctions? I mean, I thought the Treasury Secretary had more to do with sanctions. I didn't know, to quote an old expression, I didn't know Larry Kudlow had a nickel in that dime as the National Economic Advisor. Does he?
Yeah, well, the problem we've got here with this administration is anyone kind of says what they want about almost anything. And the president talks to almost anyone he wants to. So, I mean, you have this ridiculous situation where the chief of staff has no real control over the access to the president. When he leaves the Oval Office and goes into his kind of private quarters, he spends from 7 to 11 o'clock at night having telephone calls with people that are completely out the loop in terms of the security situation and understanding what should or shouldn't be done. And he listens to them. And if you know, we had Bob Corker this week talking about how the chaos, and it was a word that he used, the chaos in terms of foreign policy in the White House is because the president leaves his work day and everybody thinks that they've agreed something. He talks to a couple of almost what Corker implied crackpots, and then he comes back in the next morning and says, "We're doing this."
Oh, sorry, Bob Corker, Republican senator from Tennessee.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what he actually said was, "My people keep me away from crackpots." The implication being that the president's people can't, and so you have this situation where no one really knows on a day-to-day basis what a policy is about anything, because they don't know whether the president spoke to someone the night before who changed his mind.
So, are we actually imposing these sanctions on Russia or not?
So, you know, as Nancy said, Nikki Haley doesn't get out ahead of things. And she does speak to the president. She's candid and she's plain spoken for the most part. But when she's going in a media interview, she's not known to just shoot from the hip. So Sarah Sanders came out and said, well, it's still under consideration. Additional sanctions, maybe a decision will be made in the near future. What's unclear is what changed. It seems very likely that Nikki Haley was told sanctions were coming. And after, as Nancy said, President Trump's address to the nation on Friday night, where he talked about potential economic and diplomatic actions, it made perfect sense. Because all these strikes, the kinetic action, none of them really took a toll on Russia, like President Trump had promised, that none of them targeted Russia in any real way. So it made sense there would be some sanctions. What's unclear is what changed in President Trump's mind between Sunday when Haley said this and when all of a sudden on Monday and Tuesday the White House started, you know, mansplaining to Nikki Haley about her job and what she understands. It's possible that because there was no Russian response, that they had some sanctions teed up and no Russian response, actual kinetic military response, they decided to hold them back. Or it's possible that, you know, Trump just changed his mind and no one ever told Nikki Haley.
Bob in Tulsa, Oklahoma has another theory. Bob writes, Haley is a bright woman. She discarded whatever Trump has done in order to pursue her personal goals and to possibly become America's first female president. Maybe. We'll get back to the Friday News Roundup in just a moment. It'll be the first time in decades that Cubans will have a president whose last name is not Castro. That story and more coming up, and more of your questions and comments in just a moment. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from CLR Mold and Mildew Stain Remover. While you're going about your day-to-day life, making dinner or getting kids to school, something's happening in the dark recesses of your house. Mold and mildew are growing. But you can fight back with CLR Mold and Mildew Stain Remover. It's tough on mold and mildew stains all around the house, and it works without bleach or harsh fumes. It even carries the EPA's Safer Choice seal. CLR Mold and Mildew Stain Remover, making the world a little cleaner.
This is Peter Sagal. When we began Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we dreamed that our rude jokes would be, in the end, the appropriate way to talk about the news. And look! It happened. Listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Let's go back to nuclear weapons for 1 second before we keep going. Russell has a question. Russell emailed, I dare you to ask the question, why can Israel and the U.S., not to mention their allies, France and the U.K., who have bombed several countries, be entitled to have nuclear weapons, but not others? Worth noting, China is the only country in the UN Security Council who's not bombed any country or tried to change a country's regime. But what about Russell's question? How do we determine who is allowed to have nuclear weapons and who's not?
Well, Israel's not supposed to have nuclear weapons. And if you remember, they haven't actually accepted that they do have them. That's one of those kind of big unknown unknowns in Israel that everybody knows they have them, but no one will actually admit that they do. So there are these gray areas, unquestionably, and, you know, whether you're allowed to have one or not. What this is really about is proliferation, in the same way that, you know, people don't want, were worried about the Iranians getting a bomb because then they thought the Saudis would want a bomb and the Qataris would want a bomb. It's looking at where the proliferation is. And in many ways in the Middle East, you know, America feels it can have some kind of containment of nuclear proliferation. And they're worried that if they end up with having the North Koreans having them, the Japanese will want them, and that will be harder to contain. So it's a containment issue rather than a why can't we have one if you've got one.
I got to say, Courtney, we're talking about denuclearization. I don't hear that much about non-proliferation these days. It feels like we've kind of, in a way, made peace, in a way, with the fact that nukes are just here to stay and that we can we can't stop them. We can only hope to contain them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's fair and true. I mean, and another issue, I completely agree with Paul about the concern about proliferation. Another one is transparency. You know, so there's the U.S. is transparent about their program. They have it for a deterrent. And you could make the argument, you know, it's the most powerful weapon known to mankind, and it hasn't been used in decades. And that's a good thing, that it's there just to deter America's enemies because they know that they have it. You know, but Russell makes a very fair point. And there are a lot of people who say that, you know, Pakistan is a nuclear power, you know, but the U.S. accepts
and they got
that.
Their weapons from North Korea.
Yes, they did.
So that's part of the issue with North Korea, is the proliferation of them selling their technology to other countries, because that's the only way they can actually make any money.
And also to potentially to terrorists, to non-state actors. That's another concern.
Let's shift gears and talk about Cuba. For the first time in decades, Cubans will have a president whose last name is not Castro. Raul Castro took over from his late brother Fidel 12 years ago. He resigned on Thursday and handed power to Miguel Mario Díaz-Canel Bermúdez, better known as Miguel Díaz-Canel. Nancy Youssef, talk about this transition of power. Why did it happen in the first place? Why did Raul Castro step down?
So that's an interesting question. He had announced that there would be term limits, 2 5-year terms, and this was reached on Thursday, and today on Díaz-Canel's 58th birthday, he now is taking over. And I think there's a feeling of that there needed, the idea of a sort of lifelong leader was no longer beneficial to Cuba. And so the pattern or this pace was sort of set. You know, so many people are calling this a new era. I kind of think of it as the beginning of a new era. They're bringing in somebody who's literally been the quiet person on the scene for decades, who's been a defender of the Communist Party, who hasn't gone outside the lines, if you will, too much, who will take over at a time while Castro remains the head of the Communist Party, which is the most powerful institution, arguably, in Cuba. And so it's sort of laying the groundwork for a slow transition, if you will. I think it's not a new era yet, but it's sort of potentially getting there. You know, the question becomes how will somebody who doesn't have the charisma of Fidel or the name behind such historic moments in Cuba, like fighting in the mountains, the Bay of Pigs, how will, and is so unknown, how will he win over the Cuban people? How will he sort of win over their hearts and minds, if you will, particularly at a period of economic stagnation in Cuba? So it's a fascinating time. He will become a metric in terms of the pace of change in a country that historically has not embraced change.
Yeah, Paul, it seems like, I mean, Cuba certainly is at a time when it needs an economic boost. And a number of, you know, you look at China with its new president that is becoming more of an economic power, even as it remains a solidly communist country. I wonder if that is part of what Díaz-Canel hopes to do for Cuba, to open it up to the world more economically, just so Cubans can survive without declaring that the revolution is over.
Yeah, and I think that's a continuation of Raul's policies. He's been really quite transformational because, as Nancy says, he will still run the Communist Party. He'll still be the head of the armed forces. So those are two big institutions that matter in Cuba. And actually, the armed forces are quite heavily involved in a lot of the capitalism that is allowed in Cuba. So that's quite important, too. So I think what we're seeing here is Raul being the figure between the old regime and what comes next. He's leading this transition. He wanted there to be kind of opening up of the economy. And it's a bit by bit process. And it's been forced on them, basically, because the Soviet Union collapsed and now Venezuela is on the verge of collapse. And they don't have any friends anywhere that can bail them out. So there is this kind of step-by-step process where you hang on to what you've got in terms of the politics of the place, but incrementally move towards opening up the economy so you can stand on your own 2 feet.
So there's a number of factors behind this, Nancy. There's not only the timing with Raul Castro, but also the fact that Cuba's other friends in the economy, you know, you don't have, you know, a leader like, you don't have Venezuela, for example, able to prop up mm-hmm. Cuba's economy. So Cuba is kind of in a place where it's got to evolve.
Yeah, one of the advantages I think Díaz-Canel has is that in a lot of ways, Raul Castro couldn't do a lot of the kinds of reforms that arguably some believe he wanted to do because of his brother. And so this allows for that transition, right, in a way that Raul Castro died just 2 years ago, and I think in a lot of ways, Fidel Castro died 2 years ago, and in a lot of ways, I think Raul Castro was hampered by Fidel in terms of the kinds of reforms he wanted to make. While they're losing friends, China congratulated the new president, and I think given the Trump administration sort of retreat from some of the changes that the Obama administration had put forth, he will have to cope with a hostile neighbor, if you will, to the north, and at the same time, that creates an opportunity for countries like Russia and China to move into Cuba.
Courtney, I was just going to ask you about that very thing, about what the change in leadership might mean for the United States' relationship with Cuba.
So, I mean, I think that probably has more to do with the U.S. leadership at this point, because there was a time, as everyone knows, a couple years ago when President Obama oversaw the opening in the embassy. There was travel restrictions were lessened, and then President Trump, who was very critical at the time, and then afterwards of good relations with Cuba, came in and reinstated some of these restrictions, travel restrictions. And he's been very outspoken about it. So I think we probably won't see a big change from what we've had in the past year plus with President Trump and Raul Castro, mainly because Miguel Diaz-Canel has come in and said he's going to continue on the same values of the revolution, and that he doesn't expect a big departure from what we've seen from the Castro legacy.
And then there was that weird sonic attack on the diplomats, which I still don't think has been resolved.
No, it hasn't.
No.
To the best of my knowledge.
But it did lead to about 2/3 of the U.S. personnel in the embassy being taken out, and there doesn't seem to be any plans to replace them.
Well, but he says he can keep the revolution going. Do we think that's credible? I mean, Fidel Castro was able to maintain power for decades on the strength of his charisma. But when he was gone, Raul Castro inherited a bit of a mess, and Miguel Díaz-Canel is inheriting a bigger mess now. In just a realistic kind of a clinical sense, how do we assess the Cuban Revolution today?
I think we look at China, because China's going through the same transition. You had Mao Zedong, who was basically kind of the Fidel Castro. You needed a figure to come in and say, we can hang on to the communism, but we've got to start evolving economically to stand on our own. That was Deng Xiaoping. He came in and did that. And now you've moved to President Xi, who was a bit like the new Cuban president, was a kind of an unknown figure that didn't have any, almost a compromise figure between the two sort of left wing and the right wing of the organizations. And then you've got Deng Xiaoping, and you've got Xi Jinping. And he's come in and been actually really radical, and has really stamped his mark on it. So, you may have this situation where you have the old revolutionary, the transitional figure, and then the new guy comes in that nobody really knows. And that could mean that he really sort of stamps his mark on the place. Or he, again, is another transitional figure, and we have evolved away from the old communist system.
There's plenty to discuss with regards to Cuba and Cuba's future. We will continue this conversation Monday when 1A visits WLRN Public Radio in Miami. And we'd love your stories about how life during the Castro regimes affected you. After all that's happened in Cuba, what are you expecting there now? We'd love you to leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. Can we back up to Syria for 1 second? Eleanor in Cleveland says, I'm really disappointed with your guests commenting on the alleged chemical attacks in Syria and other issues. Your commentators are so certain no one else could have been responsible for the attack. Seriously? Courtney?
Well, it's not our role to be certain. It's our role to report on the intelligence that we're informed of. And I think if anyone who covers intelligence knows that it's never 100%. It's never even 99%. So while Eleanor certainly has a point about that, there really is no other clear alternative at this point for someone who would have carried out this attack. They were barrels that were dropped out of helicopters. No one else is flying helicopters in that area at this point, certainly not the United States or any of the allies. So unfortunately, intelligence is leading to conclusions without having the exact answer all the time.
Got to shift gears to the UK before our time is up. On Tuesday, Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May told Caribbean leaders face-to-face that she was genuinely sorry for the harassment of up to 50,000 British people of Caribbean origin. They had been asked to prove that they have the right to stay in the UK. But her words failed to placate campaigners for the so-called Windrush generation, folks who arrived in the UK before 1971. David Lammy, who is a Minister of Parliament in the UK, his parents moved there from Guyana. He demanded answers from Britain's Home Secretary.
This is a day of national shame, and it has come about because of a hostile environment policy that was begun under her prime minister. Let us call it as it is. If you lay down with dogs, you get fleas. And that is what has happened with this far-right rhetoric. Can she explain how quickly this team will act to ensure that the thousands of British men and women denied their rights in this country under her watch in the Home Office are satisfied?
Yeah. That's UK Minister of Parliament David Lammy demanding answers from Britain's Home Secretary. Paul, I know our time is short, but can you give us the significance? What's this story about the Windrush generation and why is it relevant now?
Okay, well, these were people that arrived in the UK between 1948 and 1971. They were called the Windrush generation in reference to a ship, the MV Empire Windrush, that began to bring them in 1948. The important thing here is that these people came, and they were asked to come into the country because there was a post-war labour shortage. And so these people came from the kind of Commonwealth countries that the UK was actually running or administrating or was actually directly in charge of. They were asked to come into the country. They came in as children on their parents' passports. Their parents have died. Many of them just assumed that they were, because they had landing cards when they arrived, that those were the documents that kept them in the country. Then about 8 years ago, in one of these kind of bureaucratic cleanups, somebody got rid of them all. And so the document that actually said you are entitled to be here was, I don't know, burned or shredded or whatever. And then you had the kind of immigration issues in the UK, and that tightened up what people could or couldn't get without certain documentation. And these people suddenly went, hang on, they went to the National Health Service, and they were being charged for things. They found they couldn't get, they couldn't rent property because they didn't have this bit of paper. And the bit of paper that said, you are entitled to be here, was destroyed. So you now have people that are as British as anyone can be, being told, go back home. And their home is the UK. They've got nowhere else to go. And it has become a massive scandal in the UK. And it's really exacerbated the whole kind of issue of immigration and a sense of what being British is all about and the multicultural society that people live in.
Something else British that caught our attention, and we'd like to get into that before our time is up. You know, the British monarchy has a lot of traditions. There's one tradition in the House of Windsor that looks like it's come to an end. The corgi has been in the royal family's doghouse since 1933. Queen Elizabeth adopted her first corgi on her 18th birthday. This week, British newspapers reported that the Queen's last surviving corgi, named Willow, died. Naturally, we had to know more about this corgi custom, so we called an expert.
Hello?
Julie?
Yes.
Hi, this is Denise Couture calling from 1A.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I'm at a dog show.
You're at a dog show. Okay.
Yeah. I'm at the corgi show.
This is perfect. Can we talk for 5 minutes?
Yeah.
You may have heard Julie Rovner on 1A talking about healthcare legislation, but she's also a corgi owner and trainer.
Well, the Queen has been breeding corgis since she was, a teenager, basically, and her last full-bred corgi died this week. She had announced some years ago that she was going to stop breeding them because she didn't really want her dogs to outlive her and be sad. Dogs do get sad when their owners pass. So she still has a couple of mixed-breed dogs. She's bred corgis with dachshunds. She has dorgies. But Willow was her last full purebred Pembroke Welsh Corgi.
Corgi plus dachshund equals dorgie. Makes perfect sense. But Julie tells us the legacy of the royal will certainly live on.
I think everyone here is sad. I mean, when you're walking your corgis down the street, people stop you and say, oh, that's the Queen's dog. And you smile and say, yes, it is. I mean, it's funny. Corgis have fallen a bit out of fashion in Britain, where the Queen is, but they are more popular than ever here in the United States. And I think the Queen's had, not a little bit to do with that.
Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent at Kaiser Health News and a corgi enthusiast. I didn't know corgis were such a thing.
Well, they are, in the UK, they are completely identified with the Queen. I mean, you don't see them wandering down the street very often. The lady's right. They have gone out of fashion in terms of people having them themselves. But you do not envisage or have a vision of the Queen without her dogs running around her feet. It's just part of the British royal family.
Paul Danahar, Washington Bureau Chief of the BBC, an erstwhile corgi expert?
No.
Well, Washington Bureau Chief. Paul, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks very much.
Nancy Youssef, National Security Reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, Nancy.
Thank you.
And Courtney Cuby, National Security and Military Reporter for NBC News. Thanks, Courtney.
Long live the Dorgie. Thank you.
Remember to send us your stories about your thoughts about life after Castro, 855-236-1A1A. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again from Miami, I'm Joshua Johnson. Enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.